Well, polling clearly shows this is the major issue that voters care about the most, but that hasn't stopped them from caring about creating jobs and getting back to the historic economic growth that we had on March 13th of this year. Absolutely, they're still concerned about getting our economy back to where it was and getting the workforce back into the jobs that they enjoyed before this pandemic hit this country.
There was an NPR Ipsos poll that was conducted at the end of July saying by about 60% or more, saying that they support a national strategy on when businesses and schools can reopen from the pandemic, and even more support for federal funding for protective equipment and testing supplies and broad access to a vaccine when one is developed. Do you think the federal government should be taking the lead on these issues, and how would that work?
The federal government's already taken the lead. But let's take a step back and remember, no one on earth knew this disease existed 8 months ago, a year ago. But if there are failures in the federal government, there have been bipartisan failures to address what a true national PPE stockpile should look like. Now that this pandemic's hit, we can make sure that we know what it's going to take to have a national strategic stockpile, but we can't go backwards and fix the fact that no one, Republican or Democrat, did what was necessary to fund a true PPE national stockpile before this pandemic hit.
Besides the health aspects of the coronavirus, there's the economic impact. What do you think is coming in terms of what the nation will have to deal with as far as restoring its economy as it contends with the coronavirus?
We've got to do what we can to make sure that we mitigate the risk of the spread of the disease, do what we can to get economic activity back to where we had it before this pandemic hit, but at the same time, make sure that we continue to invest in the programs that are necessary to get our economy moving once this disease is slow. Now, that means looking at our small businesses. We did what we could in a bipartisan way to keep them alive, and we've got to continue to look at them and their viability because they're the ones that make up our local economies back home.
What's your main campaign message for the November election, especially as more voters start really paying attention to the decision they'll be making?
My main message is I've delivered on the promises that I made. I promised to be a bipartisan legislator in Washington, D.C. I'm the 13th ranked most bipartisan member of the House of Representatives out of 435 members by the Lugar Center, which is the gold standard in measuring bipartisanship in Washington. And we need bipartisan solutions now more than ever in Washington. And I'm the person to make that happen.
And that's something I wanted to ask you about that that ranking. What does that mean in a practical level? And why aren't more members of Congress up in the higher rankings?
You know, I don't know that, but that's something that I've strived for since I got to Washington and promised I would do before I asked voters to cast their vote for me back in 2012. Some of my best friends in Washington are on the other side of the aisle. We sit down together and we look at legislative solutions on major bills like the Farm Bill, major bills like highway infrastructure and water infrastructure bills. These are areas where I work with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, and we had bipartisan success.
Both you and your opponent have talked a lot about healthcare. Can you explain what you want to do, what you think could get done in 2021 to move towards some sort of agreement and a greater coverage for Americans?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, albeit with good procedures and policies like protecting pre-existing condition coverage for every American, which I support and will never sacrifice, there are still problems with that legislation. And it's the problems that have left 60 million Americans behind. 29 million Americans still don't have access to healthcare coverage. 31 million more Americans have coverage that if they were diagnosed with a pre-existing condition, they can't afford to use it. I tried to fix that by voting for a piece of legislation I helped negotiate that would have protected pre-existing condition coverage for every single American. It would have lowered premiums for Americans so that insurance coverage could have been more affordable for those 60 million Americans. So what we do now is I think we have to take a look back at some of the solutions that I and many others put forth.
In terms of the proposals that you're making, what can you tell me substantive about how many Americans can be covered on at a practical level with healthcare.
Well, the plan that I voted for a couple of years ago would have lowered premiums. And when you lower the cost, then you're going to lower the number of the 60 million Americans who still have no healthcare coverage or can't afford to use the coverage they had. Affordability remains an issue. Accessibility remains an issue for those who need access the most, especially those on Medicaid. But I've actually proposed many proposals, and one in particular during this pandemic is to extend COBRA coverage. My bill would allow for a subsidy to cover the employer share of the healthcare coverage under COBRA so that employees who may have been adversely affected by losing their job or possibly being furloughed because of this pandemic could still afford to have the coverage that they know and they may be using.
In the wake of the police killing of George Floyd, there have been nationwide protests, including protests in many 13th district communities. How should policing change in this country? And is there a role that Congress should play in any such change?
There clearly is a role. That's why I've co-sponsored the companion legislation to a bill that my colleague, Senator Tim Scott, wrote in the Senate. Tim Scott is an African-American Republican. He tells a story of racial profiling, even at the Capitol, as an elected official. He has laid out a piece of legislation that would implement many of the things that we've already put in place here in Illinois, which are better training programs to talk about de-escalation techniques, to introduce social justice issues. It puts in place many different procedures and protocols to do what I think needs to be done in the United States to address issues within law enforcement. But at the same time, we've got to recognize that 99.9% of law enforcement officers in this country do their job every day to protect every single American, regardless of who you are or what you look like.
Been a lot of back and forth between you and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan on campaign financing. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan criticizes you for taking corporate PAC money, notably from the pharmaceutical industry. She claims you vote accordingly. You have criticized her fundraising. If I understand it, includes taking money from lobbyists and executives in lieu of PACs, and also working with Michael Madigan, the Illinois House Speaker and State Democratic Party Chairman. Can you refute your opponent's main charge that taking campaign funding from corporate PACs must affect what you do as a congressman?
Corporate PACs are funded by the people who work for those corporations. It's their personal money. And that's something that they decide to invest in candidates that they think are going to best represent them. But Betsy Londrigan's a hypocrite. Betsy Londrigan talks about not taking corporate PAC money, but she takes millions of dollars in contributions from people like Nancy Pelosi, who also take corporate PAC contributions like I do. She takes money from many of my colleagues who are supporting her campaign by using the same corporate PAC dollars to then give to Betsy through their campaign. That's something that I think the voters see through. They know that there's no way that I'm ever going to be bought for a single penny to cast a vote the way that I shouldn't cast on behalf of my constituents. That's something that is very frustrating in politics, but don't be a hypocrite when it comes to campaign finances. When you're taking the same money that you're criticizing me for, you're just laundering it through other people like Nancy Pelosi.
Can you tell me a little bit about the charge your campaign and the NRCC have made against Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan concerning ties to Mr. Madigan?
It's the truth. The sheer fact that Betsy Londrigan has filed a joint fundraising agreement with Mike Madigan, who runs the Illinois Democratic Party, it shows that they're tied hand in hand. I think it's pretty telling. She wants to make sure that she gets money through Michael Madigan because she hasn't said that he should immediately step down. She's also taken money directly from lobbyists who used to work for Mike Madigan, who were lobbying for ComEd. That to me shows how tight she is and how intertwined she is with Mike Madigan's operation. Mike Madigan is not only the longest serving Speaker of the House in our nation's history, after seeing that ComEd was willing to pay a $200 million fine that specifically would not come at the cost of ratepayers, and they're going to testify that there was a scheme to influence Mike Madigan, and Mike Madigan's associates led that scheme, I think it's pretty telling. And many of those same associates that were wiretapped or wearing wires are the same people who have given time and time again to my opponent, Betsy Londrigan.
And you're saying that's going to affect her performance if she's elected?
When you look at polling in my district, Mike Madigan's not too popular. And the sheer fact that she's continuing to associate herself with Mike Madigan, and frankly, has been funded by the people who worked directly for Mike Madigan, but then went out and lobbied directly for ComEd during a time when ComEd has admitted that they were doing favors for Mike Madigan. Those are the people that have directly given to my opponent. ComEd's direct lobbyists who were appointed because Mike Madigan told them to be appointed as ComEd lobbyists. I think that's pretty telling about the deep roots of corruption within the Illinois Democratic Party that my opponent, Betsy Londrigan, has been a part of for decades.
Can you tell me about another issue, maybe something that other people aren't talking about at this point that you think is really important to be addressing in your next term?
Well, I think what we have to do is look at making sure our agricultural communities and our infrastructure within our communities is our top priorities. I have gone to Washington, D.C. and sought a seat on the Ag Committee and the Transportation Committee. And I've worked hand in hand to make sure that we have good risk management tools in place so that our farmers can continue to take the risk that they do every year. We have put together the effective risk management tools to make sure they can take that risk every year, but we also have to make sure that they are our top priority. But infrastructure is where Washington has failed over the last few years. I'm continuing to lead as the ranking member of the Highways and Transit Subcommittee to be a bipartisan voice for infrastructure investment within our communities. Those are two areas that are extremely important to this district and to the voters of this district. And I'm going to continue to put my focus on succeeding for those industries and also for my constituents within those areas. And we need to look ahead and we need to do better. And that's why I need to go back.